Micah chapter 1, verse 2, the beginning of Micah's prophecy. Hear, you peoples, all of you. Listen, O earth, and all that is in it. Let the Lord Yahweh be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple, Jerusalem. Now, this is addressed to Samaria and Jerusalem. For lo, Yahweh is coming out of his place and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth. Then the mountains will melt under him and the valleys will burst open like wax near the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. The imagery is of God coming down from heaven, of course, where God dwells, is heaven, and like a warrior to actually attack the people who are misbehaving on the world. The imagery seems to come was related to the imagery of Exodus 19, which is God on the Mount of Sinai, coming down on the mountain, the God of hosts, the powerful of the armies of heaven. And I've also referred to there's a lot of this in the Bible, a kind of a mythical cosmic battle between God and whatever it is, the monsters of the deep and the evil and chaos and so on. So it's imagery, it's poetry, but you get the message. Why is this? All this is for the rebellion of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. Jacob and Israel, Jacob is called Israel. So when you see Jacob and Israel, you've got to watch carefully, because sometimes Israel means the northern kingdom. Here it clearly means the whole lot, because Jacob is the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. So you've got, this is a mutual thing. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria, the capital? What is the high places of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? And is he referring there? He might be, because we know, from the book of Kings, Ahaz is supposed to have worshipped foreign gods, and he also dreadfully took children down into the valley of Gehenna and offered them to the god Molech, as a kind of sacrifice. But that's, you remember in the Greek Battle of Troy, who was it? Agamemnon sacrificed his daughter Iphigenia to the gods. It was kind of, if you give that thing which is most precious to you to the gods, these angry gods of the heavens, and then maybe their anger will be assuaged and they'll come. And it's a very dreadful image to have, but it's around, and it was around then. And the king, probably troubled by all this stuff coming from Israel and Syria, Aram, he's kind of thinking, well, I better get the gods on side. And all of that is being referred to here in this passage. Therefore, this is the threat, God speaking through Micah, I will make Samaria a heap in the open country, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour down her stones into the valley. I will uncover her foundations. Samaria was built by Omri in the 880s or something BC, and it's actually their other capital, the northern Israel's capital, was Tirzah, which was facing in towards the Jordan. And quite significantly, when Omri, who was the greatest king in this area of the world at that stage, wasn't the king of Judah, he built Samaria on the western slopes of the ridge, facing the Mediterranean and trade and the world. So here it's going to be, and the stones are going to, it's on a hillside, so it's going to fall into the valley. All her images, idols, will be beaten to pieces. All her wages shall be burned with fire. All her idols I will lay waste. For as the wages of a prostitute she gathered them, and for the wages of a prostitute they shall go back. They've prostituted themselves by going over to the other countries and bringing in their idols, whether it's from Phoenicia or from Assyria or wherever, and that's the prostitution, it's, you know, from God, the unfaithful to the covenant. Well, their idols are going to be taken back as booty by a conquering army in punishment for their failure to be faithful to the covenant. For this, Micah goes on, I will lament and wail. I will go barefoot and naked. I will make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches. For her wound is incurable. A bit difficult here, but the trouble is with the genitive in all of these languages, including our own. It's very hard sometimes to be able to know what the of means. May I just give you an example in English? Love of God. Is that the love God has for you or the love you have for God? You know, the of is very general, very unspecific. And often in the Bible is meant to be all-encompassing because it's left unspecific. It could be love from God or love to God. But when it says of, it's just a genitive which says, read that noun or sub in the light of the other one. So her wound, her is probably Samaria in this context. Wound, is it the wound that Samaria has or, which I'm suggesting to you, the wound that Samaria is inflicting? Do you see the problem? Her wound, we'd normally think the wound that's received, but no, in this case, her wound, I suggest to you, most probably, is the wound that Samaria is inflicting on Judah, which I've told you about, under Pekah, etc., trying to force Ahaz or his kingdom into an alliance against the Assyrians, which was, of course, a foolish thing. Isaiah speaks about it at great length. So her wound is incurable. The wound that's come to Judah from Samaria is incurable. That's Samaria, has come to Judah. It, that is the wound, has reached to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. So they've already ransacked and all the cities around. Now they're right at the very gates of Jerusalem. Disaster has come down from Yahweh to the gate of Jerusalem. How often do I need to remind you? I'm not sure, but pardon me for reminding you again. See, the assumption that's through all these texts, in fact, it's through every text of the Old Testament, the assumption is that if something happens, God is doing it. Now, that's a connection that's terribly dangerous and led to dreadful theologies about the crucifixion of Jesus even, because it seeped its way back into theology. So it's a dreadful thing because it means that everything that happens, good or ill, is finally put to God, who is the cause of it, or the permits it, or whatever other word you're going to use. But he's the final arbiter of what is allowed and not allowed. I've said that often enough to be clear, haven't I? Well, that's the assumption behind here. The disaster has come from Yahweh. So look, our city's under siege or whatever's happening at the time. Not very specific. Judah is crumbling, etc., and wounded by the northern country. So it's come from Yahweh. Why? Well, he's already said something a little bit about. He then has to think, why did it happen? And he starts to give reasons. And the failure of the people to care properly for the covenant. Then he says, woe. Woe to those who devise wickedness and evil deeds on their beds. When the morning dawns, they do it because it is in their power. That's a very good line that's very relevant today, isn't it? You can't just do something because you can do it. But often in the public sphere and in every other sphere, scientific sphere as well, there's no moral compass to determine. Wasn't Einstein regretful of some of the things he'd shown possible when the atom bomb came out? I mean, science can have colossal effects that are so. It doesn't mean you stop science, but it means you need a moral in the country. There has to be moral principles that people accept. Because in their case, I think it's a great line, they performed it because it was in their power. That's it. That's enough. There's no discernment. They coveted fields and seized them. So we're back with Amos a bit, aren't we? They wanted this field, so they grabbed it from the poor. Houses, they took them away. They oppressed householder and house, people and their inheritance. So he is typically of the prophets, their concern for justice, because God is God and the covenant is about justice. And I've given you just another, I could do many, but I won't. Isaiah chapter 5 says the same thing, and they're contemporaries. Isaiah, woe to you who join house to house, field to field, until there's room for no one but you. You are left to live alone in the midst of the land. Yahweh of hosts has sworn in my hearing, this is Isaiah now, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. Then he talks about what he has to suffer. Don't preach, thus they preach. They means his rivals. We've already seen that in the case of Amos, who was told not to preach the kind of stuff he was preaching in the pulpits or the equivalent in Bethel. Well, they're saying don't preach. They won't preach such things. They won't preach what Mike has just said about injustice and about the folly of what's going on. They won't say that. God will not withdraw, causing us shame. They're quite sure, these other prophets, these other preachers, they're saying, no, we'll be right. Judah's okay. God won't ever abandon Judah because we're God's special city. This is where his temple is. This, everything's fine here. And whatever happens, we'll be safe. When we do Jeremiah later, he's full of stuff contradicting that, because that was the general opinion. That was the general preaching that people were hearing from their pulpits. He, that is God, won't withdraw from us. No, he won't cause us shame. Then Micah complains. Sometimes, see, we're dealing with two things. We're dealing with poetry, and I'm trying to give you my best understanding of that text, but if you read the scholars on it, you'll find it's confused. It's not a very clear text. Like, the text itself is, it's so much like cut and thrust that it's often, as with any poetry, it's often not that easy to get the concepts in it. But just offering you what seems to me, in the light of my study, to be the most probable way to go. Should this be said, O house of Jacob? Should you be saying this, that God will never abandon us, that we won't withdraw? Is Yahweh's patient spirit exhausted? Are these his doings? Is Micah beginning to question, as I've already done with you? Is Micah saying, are you sure Yahweh's behind this? You know, that, like, he's struggling with the theology of the day. Did not my words, that's Micah's words, do good to one who walks with the upright? You're telling me to not preach, you're telling me to stop saying this, but are you sure, isn't this what I'm trying to get at? Isn't this true, what I'm saying about the rich and the violence and all that? Should I be silent? Are you sure God isn't wherever? You know, so he's struggling to make his point. Yesterday he, I presume the rival prophet, stood up against my people as an enemy. You stripped off the robe from the peaceful, from those who were passing through trustingly, returning from war. I think that's the war we're talking about, the 734 to 732 war. People coming back from war. The women of my people you drove out from their pleasant houses, from their young children you took away my glory forever. Did people take the opportunity while the man of the house was away in the north, struggling in the war, did they take the opportunity to move in and move people out, women and children out of their homes? Is that what he's getting at? I think so. But you just have to feel your way through it a little bit to be sure of it. And then, typical of the prophets, having struggled with all this, he then, because their key focus is always God, they never let that go. He says, I, God, I will surely gather all of you, O Jacob. It's true that God is faithful, he's saying. God is faithful. He may have even used words such as, God's love is unconditional, unconditionally offered. And that's true, isn't it? But to receive God's love, it's conditionally received. The Son is pouring in to the room, unconditionally, if you like. But if we pull the blinds down, the sun is still shining, but we're not getting it. So one has to, we're free, we have to be open to grace. Grace will always be there, as we had on the Sunday readings, you know, the earth is full of the glory of God. It is there. But if I'm not receiving it, then I'm behaving badly because I'm not letting the love in. I will surely gather you. I will surely gather you, Jacob. I will gather the survivors of Israel. I'll set them together like sheep in Bozra. Bozra is the ancient capital of Edom in the south. Bozra, the word itself, means something like wine press or harvesting of wine. So it was an area for viticulture as well. So it was a wine-growing area. Like a flock in its fold, it will resound with people. With people. Pardon me if I give you this bit of erudition. The Hebrew is me adam. Me adam is used not for male. It's never used for male or female. It's adam is human race, us, people, humanity. Homo in Latin. So it covers everyone, independent of gender. But me adam may be with people, but exactly the same consonants is Edom. You can almost hear it in English, can't you? Adam, Edom. It's the same consonants. And the text is consonantal. It's only consonants in Hebrew. It was the Masoretes in whatever it was, the 9th century or something, who added points in it and vowels and made up little dots and squiggles to give you the... So in a way, this may mean, sorry to go on with it, it will resound in Edom, is a possible translation, or with people. I don't know, of course. The one who breaks out went up before them. They broke through and passed through the gate, going out by it. Their king, this is God, went through ahead of them, Yahweh at their head. So yes, all this war is going on for reasons that he's touched on, but Yahweh will come, and Yahweh, the warrior king, will lead us to victory. That's the basic gist of that passage, as I understand it, reminding them that they must change their behavior, but Yahweh will always be faithful to the covenant. Thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets who lead my people astray. Once again, you've got a prophet who's critical of other prophets. So the discernment of who's the prophet in any community is a pretty big task, as you'd well imagine, and often you can't see till later. Thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets who lead my people astray, who put the bite on with their fangs and cry, peace, but declare war against those who put nothing into their mouths, put nothing on the plate. Therefore, night to you from vision, you're not going to see anything. Dark to you from divination, all the different ways of trying to work out God's will by looking maybe at the entrails of birds, or whether a bird goes from the right to the left of a field, or the left to the right, or because they're full of superstition too, as probably we might be too, different levels. The sun will go down upon the prophets, and the day will be black over them. The seers, those who have visions, will be disgraced. Didn't we just have one recently who said the end of the world was coming? Was it yesterday? whatever day it was. They're not often that clear, but how stupid to be that clear when everyone's been wrong forever, being clear. But anyhow, they'll find a way around it, a way of interpreting it, and people will still go into their church and all that'll still happen. The seers will be disgraced, the diviners confounded, they'll all cover their lips, for there's no answer from God. God will be silent. But as for me, says Micah, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of Yahweh, with justice and with might, to declare to Jacob his rebellion and to Israel his sin. So they're not going to shut Micah up, is the point. And now I've got this little thing to show you. I'm only showing you because one of your members gave me the copies of this. Gustave Doré is a Frenchman who in about the year 1870 did a whole lot of illustrations for, I think it was the Nuremberg Bible or whatever. Apparently he's quite famous. And that's the one he had for Micah in the Bible. It's a bit odd, really, because the countryside looks more like 1870 than it. Anyhow, whatever about it, there's Micah saying, I'll read it to you again, as that those drongo lot, they're not going to see anything. God's not going to talk to them. They're full of whatever. As for me, I am filled with power and with the Spirit of Yahweh, with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his rebellion and to Israel his sin. Hear this, you rulers of the house of Jacob and chiefs of the house of Israel, who abhor justice. Gee, we can't miss that, can we? And pervert all equity, uprightness. The word basically means going straight rather than crooked. That's the image behind that word. He who builds Zion with blood and Jerusalem with wrong. Now, we know, I've got a little note there for you, Ahaz was involved in a lot of building in Jerusalem, as I suppose every king is. And in 2 Chronicles 28:3, talks about him following that dreadful practice of neighbouring lands in sacrificing their sons in the valley of is this the blood that Micah is speaking of there? Or is the blood the lives of those whose property has been unjustly confiscated? Could be either. Its rulers, back to Micah, its rulers give judgment for a bribe. Its priests teach for a price. Its prophets give oracles for money. Yet they lean upon Yahweh and they say, surely Yahweh is with us. No harm shall come to us. Therefore, because of you, he says, coming out directly against the priests and the prophets and the administrators of justice, so there's not too many he's not aiming his thing at, because of you, Zion will be ploughed as a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. Chapter 4. An interesting passage for a number of reasons. This passage is word for word also in the scroll of Isaiah. This doesn't happen anywhere else. It's Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2 to 4, and Micah chapter 4, verse 1 to 3. Is the same passage. The most likely situation that I could suggest to you is that what we've got is we've got a floating passage and no one was quite... They knew it came, this passage, this little thing that was written down probably. They weren't sure who said it because they're both contemporaries. So some thought, oh no, Isaiah said that. They said, no, it was Micah. No, I was there. It was certainly Isaiah. No, you weren't there. That was the year before, etc., etc., etc. So it ends up in two different separate scrolls. But it's another little help to make you realise when you're reading the scrolls, you're reading human documents that have been put together as best they can with the best insight people have got. So let's let the passage speak for itself, because who wrote it is not as significant as what it says. It will come about in the end of the days. The mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. Poetry, if you've ever been to Jerusalem, Jerusalem is quite high, I don't remember the exact height, if you do tell me, but when you're in Jerusalem you look up towards, across the Kidron Valley, don't you, to the Mount of Olives, which rises a good deal higher than it. So here you've got this mountain, which isn't the highest of the mountains, though significant enough, is going to be raised up and looked down on every other one. Peoples, this is a beautiful promise or hope or dream, or what is it? People will stream to it. Many nations will come, and they'll say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. I'm going to read for you in a minute a couple of texts from other places that say that similar thing beautifully, and you ought to be able to see how the New Testament saw Christianity as the fulfillment of this. Luke picks it up. From Jerusalem will go out, you know, the word, and that's the way Luke structures his Acts of the Apostles. Starts in Jerusalem and goes to Samaria and then to Syria, etc., and then to Rome, ends in Rome, goes to the ends of the world. So people from all nations are streaming into Jerusalem. Yes, this is the Catholicity of Christianity. And many nations will come and say, come, let's go to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways. Torah means teaching, literally, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion will go instruction, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples. He will arbitrate between strong nations far away. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation. They will not train for war any more. You can't call it a prophecy. I mean, when's that going to be fulfilled?
I'm still waiting for it.
That's it. So be careful of the word prophecy. See, he's not looking into a crystal ball and seeing something that's going to happen, and everyone else can say, that's happening now, it's going to happen tomorrow, it'll happen next week. It's not like that. What he's doing, I believe, anyhow, is in spite of the mess that's going on here, he's looking into God, really. He's a seer. He's looking at who God is, and knowing God's love and God's paradise that he wants the world to be, he won't let that dream go. How it happens, when it happens, it's nothing to do with him. He hasn't got the faintest idea. But that, God's intention is that the world be a paradise, that there be a new heaven and a new earth, is clearly his view. And that war is an atrocity against the will of God is clearly his view, however necessary it might be to defend oneself against aggressors and all that stuff that we need to argue about. And it's all part of our argument. But there's a kind of a dream, a vision, you might call it, a conviction based not on human behaviour, but on the nature of God. And I'll read you two other passages from the Bible that there's many, but I'll read you these two, one from Psalm 24 and the other from Zechariah 8, saying the same thing. So here's Psalm 24. Who shall ascend the hill of Yahweh? Who shall stand in his holy place? Those who have clean hands and pure hearts, who do not lift up their souls to what is false. Soul is not a Hebrew concept. Body and soul is a Greek, strange really, not very effective, it's not a very good thing, dichotomy we tend to make. No, when they use the word nephesh, which is soul, they're talking about you, one person, and it's your deepest longings, it's your, perhaps the nearest I can think of it is when you talk about, in the American, you know, the soul music, It's kind of music that kind of gets into you and picks up everything about, well, your soul is your you at the level of your deepest longings. That's as good as I can put it. So they lift up their soul to what is false, dear, oh dear, and they don't swear, don't swear deceitfully. They will receive blessings from Yahweh and vindication from the God of salvation. Such is the company of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. That's talking about the internal virtuous qualities. And here's Zechariah, who was about the year 520, so a bit later than where we are now. Many peoples and strong nations, this is after the exile, shall come to seek Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem and to entreat the favor of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, in those days, 10 men from nations of every language will take hold of a Jew, grasping his garment and saying, let's go with you. We've heard that God is with you. I think that's lovely. They'll want to know what is it that makes Judaism so beautiful, just as we would want to know what is it that makes Christianity so beautiful, which is totally obvious, really, and what is it that makes Catholic Christianity so beautiful. And there have been times in history when it's looked beautiful. We've got a job to do. We have no right to allow the church's face not to be seen to be what the church's heart is. So we've got to do it in our own life, of course. That's the primary commitment. But we're also responsible for the community. And we can't allow... We're not allowed to allow. We've got to do what Micah did, if it's your role or whatever it is. We can't allow the church to hide behind stuff that makes it look unjust to the world, can we? Because it's too beautiful and important that people who are hungering and thirsting look to the church and say, here we are. Grab you by the sleeve and say, hey, we want to go with you because God is clearly with you. Well, that's how Micah felt about the beautiful religion to which he belonged. Here's another image. This is still a promise. They shall all sit under their own vines and under their own fig trees. There we are. All you people who are on the brink of retirement. You can hardly wait. I know grandchildren, but you can take your grandchildren out under the fig tree. That's my image of retirement. It'll happen one day. To sit under my own vine and fig tree and just do a Sudoku when I want to. Or have a red wine and something just gentle and quiet. And that was their dream. This was kind of, is it bucolic? Is that the word? It's the kind of life that's away from the busy Parramatta roads of this world. They shall sit under their own vines and under their own fig trees, and no one will make them afraid. For the mouth of Yahweh of hosts has spoken. For all the peoples will walk, each in the name of its God. But we will walk in the name of Yahweh, our God, forever and ever. Beautiful creedal statement. He's referring back to the Golden Age, which is always a myth. You know, looking back to the Golden Age, it was the age of Solomon. Before the division, when David and Solomon, they had the United Kingdom, and they dreamed about it and they exaggerated it like heck. And if you read any of the archaeological findings that we now know from this, David was apparently a bit more like one of those, what would you call them? Mujahideen or something up in the hill country of Pakistan or Afghanistan, like a hill country. It was a warlord, yeah, kind of more like that, really. And when they paint these pictures of David's kingdom and Solomon's temple and Solomon's this and all that, you've got to, you know, do a bit of study to see how much of it is dreams. Mm-hmm. Like, we've got them too. When I was a child, my father told me that we were descended from the kings of Ireland. What are you laughing about? I was. I mean, I thought that was pretty impressive, really. I grew up to find out that everyone on every hill in Ireland was a king. So, and in fact, our family came from a place called Knockrockery in Roscommon, and I found out that Knockrockery means Hangman's Hill. Knock is hill and Crockery means Hangman's Hill. So someone escaped just in time. And okay, so that's their dream. This is the golden age, because during Solomon's lifetime, this is 1 Kings 4:25 reads, quote, "During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan, right up in the north, to Beersheba, right down the south, all of them under their vines and fig trees." So there we are. Let's do it together. Let's retire together. By the way, have you ever been troubled by that strange passage in the Gospel where Pete there at the end, and they go and Jesus curses, that's a pretty strong, the fig tree, and then Peter comes back and says, "Hey, that fig tree you cursed has got no fruit." Mark goes to the trouble to help us fundamentalists read it properly when he says in brackets, "It wasn't the season for figs." The others leave that out, but thank God for Mark. And Jesus, being a country boy from way back, it was full of... Of course there was no figs there. Do you think Jesus is that stupid? But the image used is just as the temple was emptied, because the temple was no longer a means of bringing people into communion with God, so the fig tree is barren. It's a statement, it's a parable, So here it is, the same, the vines and the fig trees. It's the peace promised has to be found not in a temple that's under the control of the Roman appointed high priests and the whoever was manipulating it. It has to be something. The only temple God's interested in is the temple of the community, the people. Of course, build a house, go for it, by all means. Architecture is so important. But it's the temple where everyone's gift is contributing, and the kind of temple we all want to be part of. So to conclude this first half with Micah chapter 4, "In that day, Yahweh says, I will assemble the lame and gather those who have been driven away and those whom I have afflicted. The lame I will make into a remnant, and those who were cast off into a strong nation. And Yahweh will reign over them in Mount Zion now and forever." Then comes something that seems to me clearly an addition later on, an updating. As the scribes, or the rabbis, let's call them, as they looked at this text later, in view of other experiences, they kind of updated Micah. They're saying, hey, what would Micah say today if he was in this situation? He'd say this. This is the implications of everything he's got in his prophecy. Do you see what I mean? It's quite a good thing to do. It's just that we wouldn't do it that way. We'd have it in a note at the side. They put it into the text because they're bringing out the inner meaning of the text as a living word to apply to each generation of people. Well, I think this is added on, and I'll ask you to guess why I think it's added on. "Why do you scream aloud? Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished? That pangs have seized you like a woman in labor. Writhe and groan, O daughter Zion, like a woman in travail. For now you will go forth from the city and camp in the open country. You will go to Babylon." What's Babylon? Yes, got to do with this. Babylon's nothing. It's in the southern part of the Assyrian Empire, and it's a town. It's not there. So it's not relevant to Micah's time. Now, you either then say he's looking into a crystal ball and foreseeing something's going to happen in 2 years' time, which you don't need to go to that extreme. There Yahweh will redeem you from the hands of your enemies. So I'm suggesting to you that sometime after the destruction of Jerusalem, or the capture of Jerusalem in 597, when there is no king, the king's gone into exile, they're saying, look what Micah was saying 150 so many years, 130 or something years earlier. And here it is. Look what's happening to us now.